You're listening to Fuller Curated, a podcast of the best conversations happening at Fuller.
My name is Carly Crouch, and I am the David Allen Hubbard Professor of Old Testament at Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Fuller Studio.
Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. That's all the Spanish I'll speak, but I do speak Spanish. Today's conversations seem extra relevant today as we see the topic of migration everywhere on the news. Just last week, the governor of my home state of Texas announced that Texas was no longer going to accept refugees. Today's conversation seems extra pertinent now, but the truth is, this conversation of migration, of human movement, has been relevant since the founding of this country, and even beyond that, unto the ancient world, as we've seen in today's papers. Today, I want to investigate what the book or books of Psalms had to say on the matter. Unlike other texts, these psalms pose as the words and perspectives of pious prayers, or psalmists, as I will call them, that span across time and moods, emphases, and situations. As such, the book of Psalms is truly polyphonic. That is, it has many voices. What did an ancient people of God think about migration, different types of moving and movement? What did they think about human and divine movers? As you may imagine, a book of 150 chapters has much to say on any given question we may pose to it. Tragically, I won't be able to give voice to all the voices in the Psalter, but students, if you're looking for a paper topic, and I know the semester has just begun, but it's never too early to find a paper topic, there's still much more work on migration in the Psalms to do. And I can't do it because I'm writing my dissertation. So you do it. The question I'll pose to the text today is, who would be considered a refugee in the mind of ancient Israel? Who would be considered a migrant, a resident alien in the Psalms? And here I will try to investigate the terms that they use. In order to answer this question, I want to draw your attention first to how the language of taking refuge, the Hebrew chasa, is used in its many contexts, and then on the use of the migrant resident alien imagery, gur, toshav. The psalmists employ this rhetoric in different ways, but what I contend is that the image of the refugee and that of the migrant, the resident alien, are all presented as key identity markers of Israel throughout the Psalter and in surprising ways. And in the theological vein, I will reflect at the end on how the Christian and the church has much to learn from these voices. So first, the language of refugee, or to take refuge. Throughout the Psalter, we see the phrase, the verb, to take refuge, at least 23 times, which depict God and his temple as refuge or a source of protection. What did it mean to take refuge or find protection in God? Who is a refugee in the Psalms? a small number of the 23 passages that mention taking refuge portrays the psalmist as one in flight, either current or future. The Psalms employ verbs of movement, primarily a Hebrew word for pursue. In Psalm 7, for example, the psalmist jumps straight in verses 1 and 2 and declares, "O Lord, my God, in you I take refuge. Save me from all my pursuers and deliver me. Or like a lion, they will tear me apart. They will drag me away with no one to rescue." While the term here for pursuer may not denote physical movement, in that the psalmist is literally being chased, the psalmist later reuses a term in verse 5 in which the physical connotation of the verb becomes evident. Here he imprecates himself with vows, these if clauses, if X, then Y, such as, "If I have repaid my ally with harm or plundered my foe without cause." And then he says, "Then let my enemy pursue and overtake me, trample my life to the ground, and lay me in the dust, Selah." We see a similar pairing of verbs in Psalm 71. Here too, the psalmist begins by proclaiming his taking refuge in God. The problem? In verse 10, the psalmist decries, "For my enemies speak concerning me, and those who watch for my life consult together. They say, 'Pursue and seize that person whom God has forsaken, for there is no one to save him.'" In both psalms, the psalmists depict their conundrum in embodied language. Even so, the refuge sought for in both of these psalms involves different actions from God. In Psalm 7, taking refuge means getting a court ruling from God, God's self. He petitions, "The Lord judges the people. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and according to the integrity that is in me." Verse 8. Meanwhile, in Psalm 71, taking refuge means God will put the psalmist's enemies to shame with this all-consuming shame, total social annihilation. Another psalm in which the psalmist physically moves, this time in a manner of walking towards war, is Psalm 18. The statement of the psalmist taking refuge in God opens up the psalm. We read, "I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So I shall be saved from my enemies." Verses 1 through 3. As a response to the psalmist's call, the poem depicts God in full divine warrior mode, who casts down hailstones and coals of fire, sends out arrows and even lightning. This imagery allows the psalmist to declare his unwavering confidence in a battle. He says in verse 29, "By you I can crush a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall." Further along, he notes that it's not just confidence God gives, but God cleared the roads for an easy journey and even trained him in combat. He writes, "For who is God except the Lord? And who is a rock besides our God? The God who girded me with strength and made my way safe, he trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. I pursued my enemies and overtook them and did not turn back until they were consumed. I struck them down so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet, for you girded me with strength for the battle," and so on and so on. Taking refuge in God here looks like waging war with God on your side and your military trainer. And of course, Psalm 91 depicts the ultimate mover, one who treks throughout the day and unto the night. Refuge in God here entails surviving the journey, crossing the land without any physical harm. A didactic voice enters the psalm in verse 9 and teaches, because you have made the Lord your refuge, the Most High your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, no scourge come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. As we can see, the verb to take refuge was invoked in different possible contexts and spheres of life. Being pursued by enemies, pursuing enemies, and of course, the more quotidian but equally dangerous, the long and overnight journey. Refuge entailed waiting for a divine legal verdict or receiving divine military assistance or divine protection along a journey. The image of being a refugee in the Psalms perhaps then stemmed from a physical reality of human movement, or at least was closely associated to human movement as it is today. In certain psalms, the verb to take refuge is not accompanied by a mention of any physical pursuit or any movement whatsoever, but is a pure metaphor for trusting in God. In 25, verses 20 to 21, for example, we read, O guard my life and deliver me. Do not let me be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. The general sense here is one of causation. Because the psalmists wait or hope for or take refuge in God, thus they should be guarded from harm. Though enemies are mentioned in the verse above in 19, there's no indication that the enemies are actively pursuing them. Likewise, in Psalm 34, 9, we see a general blessing with no persecution in sight. The verse reads, O taste and see that the Lord is good. Happy are those who take refuge in him. This verse is in the context of those who, quote, fear the Lord, that is, worship him, in the immediate verses. In fact, this entire psalm is one filled with praise of God and instructions for others to partake in the praise and to learn more about God's deed and about God's character. This is also the case for Psalm 37, verse 40, where the psalmist states that God will free and rescue the just, for, quote, they take refuge in him. There are no enemies in pursuit here, no journeys being embarked on, but a general observation about God's character and God's people who, quote, wait for the Lord and are blameless and upright, end quote. Coincidentally, these instances of taking refuge that fall under the semantic orbit of trusting in without any apparent reference to movement appear in acrostic psalms. That is, the first letter of a verse or stanza begins with a letter of the alphabet in sequential order. These tend to lean more to the didactic side, teaching the psalmist and his audience, and in this instance, teaching specifically, that the marker of identity of the just and righteous before God is one who seeks refuge, that is, a refugee. While many scholars have noted the metaphorical currency that the verb taking refuge carries in the Psalms, the literal rendition of God's temple as a place of refuge, as an asylum, is also voiced within the Psalter. In Psalm 61, the image of God and the temple is one as an asylum, and here it is quite evident. The psalmist begins his request for God to listen to his prayer as his heart faints within him, for an enemy is against him. He calls out to God, for you are my refuge, a strong tower against the enemy, in verse 3. This verse sounds like many other metaphorical uses of the phrase in the Psalms we've discussed. But then, in the following verses, the psalmist's tension seems to be resolved, for he concludes, "I shall dwell in your tent forever. I shall take refuge under the shelter of your wings." Though the psalmist faces an enemy, he chooses to seek asylum in God's tent, that is, God's temple. God literally becomes a refuge through a tent, through the temple. That this tent refers to the temple is also evident at the closing of the psalm, where the psalmist sings to God and pays his vows, two activities that occurred at the temple. We also see this notion of the temple being an asylum in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 51. When Adonijah flees from Solomon and holds on to the horns of the altar in search of physical protection. In Psalm 36, we open the curtain and see crime personified, who speaks to the wicked. Crime seduces the wicked in the opening verses and indulges in all things evil. By contrast, the psalmist declares, "God is ever faithful. Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens," he cries out. "Your faithfulness to the clouds, your righteousness is like the mountains of God. Your rulings are like the great deep. You save humans and animals alike, O Lord." Verses 5 and 6. The very manifestation of God's steadfast love and salvation, according to the psalmist, is in the following verse, in that, quote, "All people may take refuge in the shadow of your wings." What does that mean? To be in the shadow of God's wings in this psalm is clarified as we read verse 8, which says that the psalmist will be feasting and drinking from the abundance of God's house. That is, he is safely sheltered away from crime personified. These examples illustrate that while metaphorical readings of taking refuge in God abound in the Psalter, literal readings are also thrown into the mix. The Psalter and its many voices keep us from simply one understanding of any particular phrase or idea. What this wide symbolic range of applications of refugee language shows us is that the idea of the refugee, one, an actual refugee or a metaphorical refugee, is part and parcel of Israel's self-identity. I will now turn to the language of migrant, resident, alien. In addition to the refugee language we have been analyzing, the language of migration to Gur in the Psalms provides another important theme of movement, though without persecution as its center. In Psalm 39, we hear the voice of the psalmist wrestling with speech. He proclaims, "Let me keep my ways from sinning with my tongue. Let me keep a muzzle on my mouth as a mouth guard, as long as the wicked are in my presence." In other words, he's biting his tongue and he's saying, right, keep your mouth shut. And this worked really well for the psalmist for a little bit. "I was mute," he says. "Still, I held my peace," he recites. But then he could not help but explode, perhaps due to fever. He says, "My heart was hot within me. In my thoughts, fire burned." And what does he do? He speaks. "Then I spoke with my tongue," he says, verse 3. In a Job-esque manner, the psalmist does not just speak. He complains to God about the lifespan of humanity. "Behold, you have made my days limited. My lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely everyone stands as mere breath." Selah, verse 5. After his little outburst, the psalmist reflects on his possible rebellion and the divine punishment he incurred. He pleads God to end his suffering. "Hear my prayer, O Lord," he says, "and lend your ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears." verse 12. And then comes the personal self descriptor. For I am a migrant with you, a resident alien like all my ancestors. Turn your gaze away from me that I may cheer up again before I go and am no more. The confessional and contrite psalmist is shattered, and in an effort to evoke God's pathos, he reminds God of his limited days, and he casts himself as a migrant and resident alien before God out of nowhere. And even though in this logic, right, he brought about his own faith. We see this characterization, this self-portrayal as migrant, again in Psalm 119:19. This psalm is famous for its length, contains a whopping 176 verses, making it the longest psalm in the Psalter. It's an acrostic artistry, and it's a unique attention to Torah, the word of God. As scholars Hossfeld and Zenger note, while the focus is on Torah of God, it is not so much on the content of the Torah, nor its nature, but on the psalmist's devotion to Torah, no matter the circumstance. In their view, the psalmist chose to escape the struggles of the world through consistent meditation on and wrestling with his scripture with the ultimate divine guidance. As an acrostic poem, each word of a major stanza, as I mentioned, begins with the same letter. In verses 17 through 24, we find the stanza that features the third letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The psalmist opens this section with a single request for a reward. To know and live by God's word. He proclaims, "Reward your slave. Let me live and let me keep your word. Unveil my eyes that I may see the wonders of your Torah." Verses 17 and 18. In the next verse, the psalmist provides God with the reason for such a reward. A migrant am I on the earth, he says. Do not hide from me your commandments. He continues this image, but with a Torah twist. He begins the next verse with, I am crushed with longing. Longing for what? As a migrant, there's so much one can imagine the psalmist longing for. But the twist comes when he says, with longing for your judgments at all times. Unlike the psalmist who craves a deeper intimacy with Torah and God, his adversaries don't. Instead, they take to insult and disrespect him, and so he petitions God for peace. Not even the antagonistic speech of princes, he says in verse 23, would keep the psalmist from meditating on Torah. The logic of this stanza seeks to show the ongoing zealous commitment of the psalmist to Torah, both as a reward and in spite of malicious speech. And so the image of the migrant is attended, not literally, but metaphorically. In the third psalm, Psalm 120, which begins a new collection of psalms known popularly as either the Songs of Ascent or the Songs of the Pilgrim, the psalmist cries and laments his current state of being persecuted by words. In the opening of the psalm, the psalmist cries out, deliver me, O Lord, from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. In other words, the speaker has been the target of malicious insults. In verse 5, the speaker continues to describe his plight, and he laments, woe is me that I live as a migrant in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. The psalmist proclaims to live in both Meshech and Kedar. However, these two regions are completely opposite of each other. Meshech, which is also mentioned in texts like Ezekiel 32:26 and 38:2-3, is located in the far northern sphere of Asia Minor. Kedar, on the other hand, is located southeast of Israel in the Arabian Peninsula. Together, these two evoke two borders of a territory which the psalmist cannot possibly be in simultaneously. Therefore, I follow scholars who think that while these locations are real and on the map, the psalmist is speaking metaphorically here. In fact, biblical writers often employ either of these two locations in order to represent a warlike and chaotic enemy. In Isaiah 21:1-17, an oracle of God reports that the glory of Kedar will come to an end, and the remaining bows of Kedar's warriors will be few. The Kedarites were known for their bow expertise, as also other ancient Near Eastern texts show. Ezekiel's apocalyptic message of two enemies, Gog and Magog, in 38 and 39, depict Meshech as an aggressive people who belong to Gog and who wreak havoc on the living. And if the geographic locations are metaphorical, so then also is his life in them as a migrant and indweller in someone else's tents. The psalmist is like an immigrant, is like a migrant in the midst of violent verbal attacks. In these three psalms, it is clear that the psalmists are struggling in some meaningful way, and the image of the migrant or resident alien has become a productive metaphor with which to approach God in their petitions. Why? Why use this particular image in these passages when they pray before God? As many scholars point out, this image of the migrant and resident alien evokes the laws that we read about in the Pentateuch, like in Exodus 22:20, 23:9, or Deuteronomy 14:29, and so on, which mention the hospitable, ideal requirements towards the migrant and resident alien, and which include providing them with food and clothes, a space in their social sphere, and/or letting them join in their festivals. The psalmists then, in portraying themselves as these migrants, request God to be generous and hospitable towards them, either by curing them of disease and forgiving them of their own verbal sin, or by liberating them from their external verbal abuse. I agree with these scholars that the laws of hospitality toward the non-native born are their primary reason for the psalmists casting themselves with these particular images. They do indeed want God to act positively towards them. But I want to press this image further. Why do the psalmists cast themselves as migrants and resident aliens when their suffering is associated with offensive speech? Why connect these two phenomena? In this ancient culture, not unlike today's culture, there's a connection between derogatory speech and the non-native born that lead the psalmist to invoke the image of the migrant and or resident alien in these three psalms. Insults against the non-Israelite was pervasive enough that to be insulted was automatically akin to being a migrant resident alien in this culture. We can glean insight of the connection of harsh speech towards a non-Israelite in the story we saw earlier today, the story of Ruth the Moabite. In Ruth 2, once they have returned to Israel, Ruth the Moabite, as she is designated throughout the book, requests permission from her mother-in-law, the Israelite Naomi, to gather food from a nearby field. Naomi grants this permission, and Ruth ends up gleaning in the field belonging to Boaz. When Boaz spots Ruth, he inquires of his head worker, "Whose young woman is this?" He reports that, quote, "She is the young Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." And he says, "She has a strong work ethic to boot." Boaz then commands her to remain close to his female slaves and shares that he's told the men not to touch her. After lunch, Boaz, moved by her courage to remain with her mother-in-law and provide for her, displays even more compassion on Ruth. And so he tells his young male workers in chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, quote, "Let her glean even among the sheaves and do not insult her." And also, "Pull out some from the bundles for her and leave them for her to glean and do not rebuke her." End quote. It's unclear from this passage whether or not the insulting speech toward Ruth the Moabite was due to her gathering skills or due to her status as Moabite, i.e. not Israelite. The book's emphasis on calling Ruth, Ruth the Moabite, may point toward the latter. We also see this connection between derogatory speech and the migrant in Psalm 44, verses 11 through 14, where the psalmist reflects on their exile. He laments, "You have made us like sheep to be eaten and scattered us throughout the nations. You sold your people for no wealth and set no high price upon them. You made us the taunt of our neighbors, derision and mockery to those around us. You have made us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples." Being forced to migrate entails being the object of insults and scorn. In Psalms 119 and 120, the petitioners report their verbal persecution, while in Psalm 39, the psalmist is the verbal bully towards God. God, he notes, punishes, and as a result, he remains mute with only his tears as his nonverbal speech. The immediate recourse the psalmist views as worthy to remediate this is to pose as a migrant and resident alien. Unlike the other two, this psalm uses the image of migrant and resident alien to portray the fleeing quality of humanity, here one day and then maybe not the next. By connecting this fleeting quality of humanity to the image of the migrant, the psalmist is pleading for God to end the punishment, since the psalmist knows that God is a God of the migrant and will take pity on him. In this society, to be a migrant was to incur slander from the surrounding nations. But as we have seen in these psalms, this image of the migrant was used to incite divine help, showing that this kind of behavior should be seen as abhorrent before God. And so now I want to do a bit of theological reflection on these comments on the psalms. I currently reside in a semi-intentional communal home for grad students in Boston, for which I am the RA, the resident advisor. Last fall, one of my residents, about my age, alerted me that her friend was about to come out of an immigration detention center. Her friend, a refugee, was fleeing the gang violence of her neighborhood in El Salvador and was caught at the border of Texas, and held first at a detainee camp in McAllen, Texas, my home area, and then subsequently taken to several detention centers across Texas for months and months. My resident then told me that she was her legal guardian and asked if she was granted to come out, if she could stay in our home, and if I could help advocate for her friend to the board of our community. I'm pleased to say that all of our peers rallied and stood behind her, signed the letter, and that the board eventually agreed to let her reside with us for the foreseeable future in an open room we had. And I was pleased to see that we remain true to the sign we have outside the building, that all are welcome here. In the conversation with this woman from El Salvador, she shared her story of violence, her wild trek across several countries, and the wonderful people she had met seeking that same refuge she did along the way. Tragically, not everyone made it, she said. So when the news came that the governor was going to use the current presidential executive order to ban refugees, I thought of my new resident. If that law had passed just a few months ago, She wouldn't be in Boston, safe, going to classes at the Y and teaching me about the Bible. It was in talking to her and hearing her recite Psalm 91 that got me thinking about this project at all. She taught and reminded me that the Bible was written by a people constantly on the move. What then do Christians have to do with migration? A primary way many ancient Israelite writers in various contexts identified themselves in the Psalms is as refugees. Jesus, too, was a constant wanderer, remaining in one place only as a temporary migrant. An identity of the people of God, then, is a people who constantly seek refuge, whether literal or metaphorical, in God. And likewise, the God of the people is one who guards and cares for his refugees of all sorts. Those who seek help in escaping violence from their persecutors, or those who are struggling in some other way. More importantly, as all are refugees, compassion, acceptance, and hospitality are a must for the Christian and the church. The temple of God, as we saw, was an actual place of asylum for the people of Israel. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul exhorts the people of God to view themselves as the temple of God. As temples of God, then, Christians have an immense responsibility for providing actual, concrete asylum for those who have been displaced. This responsibility is even more so the case because of that twofold identity as both place of refuge and refugee. We must remember that even what we have been given from God, has been given from God and has been given to us for the purpose of sharing with those who likewise seek the help of God. Moreover, in light of the connection in the Psalms between the status of the migrant and the hate speech that is often brought against those who are on the move, Christians have a further responsibility to combat any and all stereotypes and derogatory speech because, as the Psalms teach us, that is what God abhors. What we see then in the many voices of the Psalms is that they come together as a collage that contains refugee, migrant, and resident alien voices that give voice to today's refugee, migrant, and resident alien and can help illumine the church's response today. Thank you.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.